From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, teaching chimpanzees language, American Sign Language. We talk with Roger Fouts about his 30 years of language research with chimps and about his efforts to protect chimps from the worst abuses that research animals can be subjected to. Fouts has written a new book called Next of Kin. Also, making movies in Hong Kong, now that it's under Chinese rule. We talk with one of Hong Kong's most celebrated filmmakers, Wong Kar-wai. His film Chungking Express was distributed in the U.S. by Quentin Tarantino. His new film, Happy Together, won the Best Director Award at this year's Cannes Film Festival. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Lisa Scottolini's new thriller, Rough Justice. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The sheriff of Monterey County, California, confirms that singer John Denver died yesterday when his experimental plane crashed in the bay. Denver's hits included Rocky Mountain High and Annie's Song. He was 53. NASA will try again Wednesday to launch the Cassini space probe to the planet Saturn. Today's attempted launch was scrubbed due to technical concerns and the weather. But the space agency says the chief concern was safety. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports.
Cassini's launch had already been delayed 1 hour because of a launch pad service gantry that failed to retract on time. Weather forecasters also gave the launch a 40% chance of being canceled due to rain and cloud cover. In the end, it was high winds that violated launch criteria. The weather outlook is the same for Tuesday, so NASA may try as soon as Wednesday to send Cassini on its way. The launch comes in two parts. First, an Air Force Titan IV rocket will carry Cassini to Earth orbit. Once the rocket separates, Cassini's Centaur booster will fire and push the spacecraft on its way. Cassini's plutonium power source prompted protests and even a federal court challenge to stop the mission. Critics say a launch pad explosion could release deadly plutonium gas into the air. NASA says the mission is safe, but nuclear response teams will still be deployed over a two-county area around the launch site. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins.
The Army has named Command Sergeant Major Robert Hall as its new senior enlisted soldier. He replaces Gene McKinney as Sergeant Major of the Army. McKinney is facing a court-martial on sexual misconduct charges, allegations he denies. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Sadako Ogata, is criticizing the international community for failing to protect refugees in Rwanda. Her comments came at the annual meeting of the UNHCR's Executive Committee. Owen Bennett-Jones reports from Geneva.
Ever since the Rwandan crisis began, Ogata has argued for more international involvement. And in her speech to the Executive Committee, she said the international community should have responded to her calls for an international military force to rescue genuine Rwandan refugees and separate them from the armed Rwandan extremists responsible for the massacres during Rwanda's civil war. Such separation never occurred, and Ogata says that undermined the UNHCR's efforts to protect innocent civilians who'd fled Rwanda. Ogata said while she remains committed to the principle of asylum, she's more than ever aware that repatriation offers the main solution to many refugee crises. The international community, she said, should work with the UNHCR to find and implement such solutions. For NPR News, I'm Owen Bennett-Jones in Geneva.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up well over 39 points at 8,084. Trading is light on the Columbus Day holiday. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up 4.5 points at 1743. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is higher on optimism about corporate earnings. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
In particular, brokerage stocks are higher, following better-than-expected earnings from Travelers Group and Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette. And banking issues have advanced on speculation of more consolidation in the industry. On the other hand, Coca-Cola has edged lower after the company's chairman and CEO, Robert Goizueta, was placed in intensive care following chemotherapy and radiation treatment. Overall, the market has been held to a narrow range on the unwillingness of investors to bet aggressively without the guidance of the Treasury market, which is closed in observance of Columbus Day. I'm Doug Krisner.
Drug firm Pharmacia Upjohn says it'll close its pharmaceutical product centers in Kalamazoo, Michigan. The company says it's looking at other sites for a new corporate headquarters. Pharmacia Upjohn says part of the Kalamazoo site will stay open. Nearly 32,000 people work for the company, two-thirds of them who live in the Kalamazoo area. It's not clear how many jobs will be affected. The company plans to relocate a new headquarters somewhere in the Mid-Atlantic region. An oil analyst says gasoline prices dropped around the country in the past 3 weeks despite tension in the Middle East. The Lundberg survey finds that the average cost of a gallon of gas, including all grades and taxes, was a little more than $1.28 per gallon. That's nearly 3 cents lower from the last survey on September 19th and about 4 cents less than the summer peak on September 4th. Analyst Trilby Lundberg points to a drop in gas usage for the price decline. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach, with over 170 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's often said that what separates humans from animals is our unique capacity for language. A language experiment that began in 1967 has shown that chimpanzees can learn to communicate with each other and with people through American Sign Language. My guest Roger Fouts joined this experiment in 1967 as the tutor of the chimpanzee Washoe. The experiment was started by Fouts' professors, but he later took it over, adding several other chimpanzees. Over the years, he's become concerned about the welfare of research animals, especially chimps. He's against keeping research chimps locked alone in cells. Fouts is now a professor of psychology at Central Washington University, where he co-directs with his wife the Chimpanzee and Human Communications Institute. It houses several research chimps, including Washoe. It has a 3-story-high, open-air mesh roof that enables the chimps to swing above their living space as if it were a rainforest. The chimp Washoe was born in Africa and was taken to America in the early days of the space program by scientists intending to launch chimps in space to test the conditions for humans. Washoe never made it into space, but when that phase of NASA's research was over, two linguistic researchers, Alan and Beatrix Gardner, Fouts' professors, picked Washoe out for their study. I asked Fouts what Washoe's living conditions were like when he started teaching her.
Well, she was raised basically as a deaf human child. My professors, the Gardners who started the project, reasoned that Chomsky didn't make sense because very few of us speak in complete sentences, certainly. I mean, there are social utterances, yes, but not complete sentences. And also Skinner didn't make sense in that I know my parents never set me down and reinforced me to talk. I simply acquired it. But one thing they did know is that where language is acquired, and language is acquired in the enriched environment of the home, the social environment. And so they created that environment for Washoe using a language that she was capable of producing. And that was a major, major change from the previous studies that all tried to teach chimps to talk vocally. Granted, they reared them in homes and treated them like children, but they were using the wrong language, the wrong modality at least.
So Washoe was raised initially in the Gardner's home?
Well, she had her own 8x24-foot trailer in their backyard, and I was hired on as one of the graduate students, and it was our job to be her human companions, to make her breakfast, to make her lunch, to change her diapers, to do her wash, to take her on outings, to, you know, watch her as she climbed the trees or play hide-and-seek with her and so on. So it was just like being a big brother.
Washoe is the first chimpanzee to prove that humans aren't the only ones with the ability for language, and she has learned a lot of American Sign Language. What are some of the things you can communicate to Washoe and to other chimpanzees that you work with?
Well, it's really quite amazing in terms of what they understand and what they demonstrate they understand. For example, one of our students was pregnant. Her name is Cat Beach, and she lost her baby. She had a miscarriage, and she was gone for about a week. And she came back, and she apologized to Washoe for not being there and explained that her baby had died. And when she told Washoe this, who, by the way, had lost two of her own children, Washoe signed "Cry Me," which shows not only a comprehension but also the ability to empathize and to express that empathy. Which is, we haven't bothered to ask the animals whether they have these things. We just assume they weren't there.
And as you point out, a lot of researchers assumed that chimpanzees couldn't communicate with language, but they equated language with speech. And chimpanzees don't have the vocal mechanisms to speak, but they do have this conceptual skill for language, sign language.
Yes, exactly. In other words, again, if you will, a certain anthropocentric and egocentric version of ourselves. We asked our fellow apes if they could talk vocally, and it was like trying to teach a dog to fly. The chimpanzee vocalizations are controlled by their limbic system, the emotional centers of their brain, and we have that too. If I stepped on your toe, you wouldn't say, "My goodness, that hurts a great deal. I better let him know by screaming." The scream just comes out. It's not voluntary. Whereas that's not true with their hands. And so by taking a humble approach, by beginning, my professors, Alan and Beatrice Gardner, basically said, "What are you about? We've got to understand your nature, and then how can we adjust to that? How can we meet your needs and take you on your terms rather than basically saying, prove my theory or don't tell me anything else at all?"
One of the things you wanted to learn was whether signing was something that chimpanzees would do in the presence of humans, but if the humans were gone, you know, so was the interest in signing. And you found out that chimpanzees would teach sign language to their offspring?
Yes. Washo, as I said, she lost two babies, and then she adopted a 10-month-old, Lulus. And we stopped signing in his presence, except for seven signs, such as what, which, who, where, sign, name, and why. But other than that, we used vocal speech, which by that time Washo had a very good comprehension of. And what we found is that he did acquire the signs, and we actually saw some tutoring on her part where she would take his hand and mold it into a sign. Then we went one step further. Debbie, my colleague and wife for the past 33 years, instituted remote video recording where we put cameras in the areas, the chimp areas, in their enclosures, or just outside their enclosures, I should say, and then videotape them with no humans present whatsoever. And this was basically a control for Lulus to make sure that it wasn't somehow a human effect. And so with humans completely removed, he still signed the signs that he acquired from Washo. And not only that, but we found that they had a great deal to talk about. In one of Debbie's 20-minute, she did 20-minute samples, three times a day, taking a sample from each hour of the day. And in one 20-minute sample, these were random, of course, there was 29 chimpanzee-to-chimpanzee conversations. Other 20-minute samples, they might be asleep or grooming or what have you, but they had a lot to talk about. And then out of that study, we found that not only do they converse with each other when we're not present, but they also talk to themselves. And that was very exciting because when we talk to ourselves, we're basically thinking aloud. And that gave us a window into chimpanzee thought, if you will, the first empirical evidence of what is going on in their head.
So tell me, what did the chimps talk to each other about?
Well, what we found is that it was primarily social. And the type of things that you talk about within a family, or at least a family with young children and so on. The two boys, Dar and Lulus, was primarily play, tickles and chase and so on. Of course, they'd get in an occasional fight. And Washo, a large part of her signing, we found had to do with the categories of reassurance, come hug, discipline, like you go, telling, you know, one of them to leave the room when she broke up a fight. And also what was interesting is that some of the people, again, that haven't bothered to read the literature have criticized and said, well, they only sign for reward. We found that food as a topic was very, very small. In fact, we looked at not only the remote video, but live observation. We looked at 5,600 instances of chimp-to-chimp conversation and found only 5% had anything to do with food. And generally, it was talking about food, such as as you might discuss the merits of a cheesecake. But it showed us that the language that they're using, and I think like the language that we still do use, is primarily social. It's only in recent times, I think, that our species has begun to use it for problem solving and going to the moon and logic and so on. But language is a social behavior. Its primary purpose is the establishment of relationships. And if you stop and think about it, if you can't establish a relationship, if you can't communicate with somebody else, then from a Darwinian point of view, that means that you're not going to breed. You'll never get a date, and you're out of the game. And then in a species like ours, or the chimpanzees, where not only do we have to get together to breed, but we have a very, very long childhood, then that relationship and that communication and that language becomes even more critical. Because if mother and child can't form a relationship, baby won't survive.
Roger Fouts is my guest. He's the author of Next of Kin, What Chimpanzees Have Taught Me About Who We Are. And for over 30 years, he's worked with Washoe, who is the first chimpanzee to actually learn language, and the language in this case is American Sign Language. Are you categorically opposed to using chimpanzees for medical or biological research?
No, I mean, that would be silly, because we use humans for biomedical and medical research. And what I would say is that because they are next of kin, quite literally, because a chimpanzee and a human share 98.4% of their genetic material, that we should apply or attempt to apply the same standards that we would for humans. And in this case, because most of them can't sign a permit, then I would make it even more appropriate, in that it would be comparable to using human children who could not say yay or nay, but you could certainly have a guardian who could see what was best for the individual and approve of it.
How did you get as involved with protecting chimpanzees as with studying them?
Well, the black and white college dichotomy between myself and my fellow animals, Washoe turned that gray very, very rapidly. And I realized that she's a person, she had the same feelings. In other words, she was literally like a member of the family. And this is not, you know, emotion. This is also objective observation.
Well, she's not a person, she's a chimpanzee.
Well, she has a personality. So in that sense, I would say, you know, what I would define a person as is somebody with a personality. Now, if you say a human person, yes, she would be a chimpanzee person. That would recognize the species difference, just as we are human people, and there are chimpanzee people.
Wait a second. I just want to question your logic here. I mean, cats and dogs have clear personalities, but we don't call them cat people and dog people.
Maybe we should.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean,
persons.
But they could have personalities without being us, right?
Yes, yes. In other words, a personality would denote a person, an individual. The alternative, the old model, basically said, you're being anthropomorphic if you're applying these special words and characteristics. And they said, what you should do is apply the words or descriptions that we use with a chair or a toaster. Quite literally, I mean, we weren't supposed to apply anything that was human to our fellow animals. And if you will, it seems to me that, I call that approach, rather than anthropomorphism, as they call the other, I call that mechanomorphism. It's attributing or it's making animals seem to be more similar to machines, which is an old Cartesian notion, than they are to their fellow animals and ourselves. I mean, we are an animal. And in our animal world, there are persons. Why can't there be persons in the chimpanzee animal world or in the dog animal world? I don't see how you could define person in such a fashion that it would exclude our fellow animals.
Well, I can. I mean, because I think it's just like linguistics here in a way. I mean, there's a difference between a dog and a cat, and there's a difference between a person and a dog. And they all share certain similar characteristics like personality. But just because we use the letters P-E-R-S-O-N and the word personality doesn't mean that we're all human. I mean,
but we're human and they're a dog. And,
right.
But we're, as a human, we also recognize that we have an individual being about us, which we refer to as person. And I think we should certainly recognize that individual beingness with them as well. In other words, human, we use that as a noun, I think, much too often, when actually we are human beings. And human is really an adjective that describes the nature of our beingness. Chimpanzees should be seen in the same fashion, chimpanzee beings. And it's really our beingness in both cases, I think, that's more important than the particular adjective that describes that.
My guest is Roger Fouts, author of the new book Next of Kin, What Chimpanzees Have Taught Me About Who We Are. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Back with Roger Fouts, he spent 30 years studying the language abilities of chimpanzees by teaching them American Sign Language. The chimpanzees that you work with are now living in a nice sanctuary, I guess is a good word. It has, you know, a lot of grassy area and a lot of vertical space so that they can climb and swing. Do you still do research with them?
Yes, we do an unusual type. Unfortunately, it's unusual. I wish more people would do this. It's called a subject-paced research. In other words, if what you would have to do if you were a researcher in our building, you would have to design something based on what the chimpanzees tell you they like doing. And if the chimps don't want to participate, they don't have to. In other words, the arrogance of science where we force animals to do things that we want them to do rather than they is not really accepted, which means you have to know your individual and the species well enough to devise a task that they want to do it. And there's individual variation. For example, one of our students looked at semantic range, asked the very simple question, when does a chimpanzee think a cookie become a cracker? And she established this, Jen Boucher was her name, she established this using Oreos, which all the chimps definitely agreed were cookies, and saltine crackers, which they all definitely agreed were crackers. And then she came up with a special recipe where you could have salty and gooey, as well as dry and salty, and also, dry and sweet, as well as gooey and sweet, sort of a salt sweet continuum in a gooey dry continuum.
I think I see where you're leading. Okay. The chimpanzees love this because they could eat all the stuff.
Well, the minute Tatu realized that the Orioles were gone, she was out of there. She said, "I have no time for this. Where are the Orioles? I don't like the stuff that you're cooking." But Dar, he loved these so much that he would have been there forever. Now, Mary Radicke did another study trying to get to see if they would mimic hand configurations in that sign language has certain letters, and so the chimps don't have them. And she wanted to see if they could have this capacity if they did a sort of an imitation game. Tatu loved correcting Mary, but Dar had no time for it. So as a result, one of those studies had Dar in it without Tatu, and the other study had Tatu without Dar. But the chimps decided which ones they wanted to participate in, not us.
When you started working with Washout, teaching her sign language, you were basically, her buddy. You'd hang around and play together and do the laundry together and go places together. And now you have a completely different arrangement with the chimpanzees. They have their own sanctuary. And the people, humans only go inside that sanctuary to clean it, mm-hmm. or to take care of the chimpanzees' medical problems. Other than that, you stay outside of it and communicate with them through the wire that what would you call it, the wire fence that holds them in. Why did you create that standard for yourself? I would imagine you'd miss even some of the physical contact with them. Some of the hugging and tickling.
Well, I do, but I was getting more benefit than they. When we would have to interact, I guess it would be comparable if someone said, "Oh, here's a young child. I want you to play football with him. He loves football, but I should tell you that this little boy is a hemophilic and he has brittle bone disease." I mean, you're going to have to be very, very careful, and that's what the chimps had to do us. We're basically defective chimps when it comes to interacting with chimps. And also, they needed each other. They do a much better job of grooming. It's nice to be groomed by a chimp, but I usually end up bleeding. They groom so, where I'm just a softy compared to them. And their tickles. In terms of strength, there's no. Thing. But Washo's an adult now, too. And in the morning when we Debbie and I go in and she gives us her blankets and the other guys do, too, she'll usually come over and give us a kiss through the wire. It's sort of a kiss good morning and maybe sign come hug or something and give us a kiss. And then she goes on about her day. And people say, "Well, don't you miss holding her?" And she piggyback rides. Well, she's an adult now. And I point out to them that our 30-year-old son, Josh, when when we happen to see him during a holiday. I might get a quick hug at the airport, and that's it. He doesn't still sit in my lap. And so, if you will, they have moved into that adult world, and they aren't children anymore. And that's part of it, is respecting the fact that they grow up, and they're not children that some people think they should be.
How do you do your language research with them if you can't go in there and interact with them?
Well, we look primarily at their communication, chimp-to-chimp communication, or, as I said, set up studies where they want to interact with us through the wire. Mary Lou Jensfeld looked at conversation and would start a conversation, and then she would put something in that was off topic and see how the chimps reacted to it. Mark Bodemer had another conversation one, and he would purposefully break it down, and he found that they would repair the conversation. For example, when his back was turned, how do you sign to somebody with their back? So what do the chimps do? They go, they make a noise, he turns around, they sign. Or if he said, what, they'd sign what they just signed again, except slower, and they might elongate the utterance, making sure he got it. Whereas if the conversation broke down when he said no, like if they said, yeah, give me some gum, he'd say no. And they'd say, how about an apple, basically? And so they would change the topic, which, again, is continuing or repair. And so all of these things are naturally occurring. They're what going on and during the day regularly. And we're just putting them into, if you will, a scientific study and looking at them.
Do you envision a day when more and more chimpanzees have learned sign language and communicate with it? I mean, do you think you've really started something here?
I hope not. I hope not. We know now. I mean, granted, we don't know all we could know, but we know enough to know what's going on. I hope to see a day when there's no chimpanzees in this country, period, and where we are spending our money to protect their communities in the wild. And so that they can be chimpanzees all the time, because Washoe, even in the great facility we have, can't be a complete chimpanzee.
Yeah, but maybe she likes her life, huh?
She does. She does. But what broke my heart was this last June, a year ago June, when we saw what it was like. We visited Gombe, and it was very exciting, but it was very poignant to know that, you know, whereas I was obviously a defective chimp, barely keeping up with the wild chimps there, good old chimps, Washoe belonged there. Washoe belonged there. She doesn't belong here. That's what evolution and all her ancestors were adapted for. And it's very, very poignant to realize that such a strong individual, this, you know, with tremendous self-esteem, what could have she given to her community had we left her where she belonged, where she was born with her people?
I've got one last question for you. When you built this wonderful sanctuary for the chimpanzees, did any of them sign thank you?
They signed hug love, and they were excited. When Washoe woke up and looked out and saw the grassy area, she started screaming and saying come hug and wanted me to come over, embraced. When they first went out, her first act, we have this on film, she comes down the stairs onto the grass, she goes over the wire, she reaches through the wire, Debbie's standing there, and she takes both of Debbie's cheeks in her two hands and pulls her forward and kisses her before she went out. And then she turned and just started running across this beautiful outdoor area, and she hadn't been out in 13 years. She appreciated it.
Oh. Well, Roger Fouts, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Roger Fouts is the author of Next of Kin. He directs the Chimpanzee and Human Communications Institute at Central Washington University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, making movies in Hong Kong under Chinese rule. We talk with director Wong Kar-wai, whose films include Chungking Express and Happy Together. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Rough Justice, the latest thriller with a tough woman heroine by Lisa Scottolini. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Wong Kar-wai is perhaps the best-known filmmaker currently working and living in Hong Kong. His family moved there from Shanghai, China in 1963 when he was five. His movie Chungking Express was the first movie that Quentin Tarantino chose to distribute in the U.S. Wong Kar-wai's new movie, Happy Together, won the Best Director Award at the Cannes Film Festival this year. Happy Together was shown last week at the New York Film Festival. The movie is about a gay couple from Hong Kong who try to revitalize their relationship by going to Buenos Aires. The film opens with a love scene. I asked Wong Kar-wai the obvious question, would he have been able to make that movie today now that Hong Kong is under Chinese rule?
I think this, the situation in Hong Kong is we have one country, two systems. If we want to make Happy Together in China, it's impossible because the censor won't say yes, and you will never get the permit to make this film in China. But in Hong Kong, it's still okay. You can make Happy Together in Hong Kong.
So has anything changed for movies since the Chinese took over?
It's been 3 months already, but still, to us, I feel it's almost the same as before. And actually, we predict there won't be any drastic change or something obvious within this very near future. And we expect the changes will be obvious only after 7 or 10 years, which is, I think, mainly on the next generation.
What did you do on the day that China took over Hong Kong? Where were you?
Actually, I was shooting something in the harbor because I just want to make a documentary or just to keep something in the cameras or on my footage. And we have captured the whole ceremonies, and we have captured the departure of the Britannia. And in fact, we expect something more dramatic or emotional, and it's the same as Chinese New Year or Christmas Eve. Of course, as a filmmaker, we're kind of disappointed, but as people who live in Hong Kong, we are very pleased because it means that everybody's well prepared, and that's good.
Now, your new movie, Happy Together, is shot in Buenos Aires. And I'm wondering why you wanted to go there to make the movie.
It's right after Fallen Angels. My film was made in 1996. And after Fallen Angels, people keep asking me about my next film. Is it about Hong Kong 1997? Which I hate this question so much because I don't have any answer at all. So I think, well, maybe I should make the film outside Hong Kong so that we don't have to answer these questions. And because I'm very fond of a South American writer called Manuel Peak, and so happened he has a novel, the title is called Buenos Aires Affair. So I think, well, why don't we make a film in Buenos Aires? And so it starts the idea of making a film in Argentina.
And why did you decide to do a movie that is gay-themed?
Because I have never touched on this subject before, and I have worked with these two actors in the film, Leslie Jung and Tony Leung, and we know each other so well. And sometimes I think they will be very good playing a couple in a film. And so I just asked them, and they said, because they thought it was a joke.
What made you think that they'd make a good couple in a movie?
Well, we've been working, like, in my third film, Ashes of Time, and they are playing sometimes with each other. And I think, well, these two guys looks alike, and they have very similar air. So I think it would be fine to ask them to play a couple in a film.
Now, how did they react to the opening scene in which they're making love? Because I would imagine, I'm not sure if this is true, I imagine that there's a lot more gay sexuality in American films and American films now than there is in Hong Kong. But maybe I'm wrong.
As I told you before that, they thought it was a joke because they know I'm always changing my script, so they don't take it for seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I was shooting the first scene on the first day, and so they are very surprised. And one of the actors, Tony Leung, is so shocked that he just remains speechless after the shooting for 3 days and keeps saying, what should I explain to my mother?
What'd you say?
Well, I told him, because he's in Chungking Express too, so I told him that if I can make you fall in love with a can of sardine in Chungking Express, why can't I make you fall in love with a man in this film? And it helps, really. And he's more relaxed after that.
That really helped, huh?
Yeah.
I bet that didn't do a lot for his mother, though.
Actually, I invite his mother to the opening night in Hong Kong, and she's very pleased with the work of his son, her son. And although Tony Leung is so tense that he get drunk on screening.
Is homosexuality a very controversial subject in Hong Kong movies now?
It's better because in the last 2 or 3 years, there's some films about gay relationships and have gay characters in the film. And normally they are paradised as something as a joke, you know, just funny guy. Or sometimes they're just being too aggressive, like I'm gay, you are not gay, so yeah, I don't like you, you don't like me. And this is also the first time that we have two really famous Asian star playing gay characters in a film. So it is quite, it makes some noise in Asian societies.
Correct me if I'm wrong and tell me if this is too personal, but my understanding is that you're heterosexual, you're straight, and I'm wondering if people have been making assumptions about you because of the movie and if that matters to you.
I always say that the film, none of the film I made is autobiographical, you know. So there's I can make a film about a killer, and I can make a film about thieves, and I can make a film about a swordsman. So I don't have to be a killer, but I can still make a film about killer.
Wong Kar-wai is my guest, and his new film is called Happy Together, and he's a film director who lives in and works out of Hong Kong. One of your earlier films, Chungking Express, really clearly shows your love of music and your love of movies. I'm wondering if you were exposed to a lot of movies and music growing up in Hong Kong.
In fact, Chungking Express and Fallen Angels to me is a film about Hong Kong. The main characters in the film is Hong Kong, the cities. And actually, it's all the music, all the sound in the film is the sound of Hong Kong. Because you can hear all this music or this kind of sound in Hong Kong everywhere. And in fact, this is the case.
What was it like for you growing up with rock and roll and pop music lyrics that you didn't understand because they were in English?
Just to me, they are just sounds, you know. They are just noise. And sometimes the sound, the music become a reference of time. Like when one song is very popular at one time, you can hear it in a coffee shop, on the taxi, on your way to the airport, and you can hear even the same song in other cities in Asia. So I think, well, sometimes music, it becomes a reference of time and reference of space. To me, I think this is sound, and this is not music.
Have you, though, been surprised now that you understand English about what some of those songs were about?
Yeah.
Is there an example of a song that surprised you once you understood the lyric?
Something like California Dreaming.
Which you use in Chungking Express.
Yes.
So what did you think it was about before you heard the lyric, before you understood the lyric?
I thought it was a song for a commercial, you know.
Did you really?
Yeah.
What did you think they were selling?
Something like orange from California. You know?
All right. So when...
Go ahead. Yeah. No, you. Because when we were kids, there's always have an image that Californians are mostly related to orange, you know. All the orange came from California. I don't know why.
And you probably didn't know what the climate was and how somebody in a colder climate would be yearning for the warmer climate of California and for for all the all the excitement that it represented in the 1960s. What year was this a hit in Hong Kong?
I don't know. I just pick up these songs, and I think this song is kind of simple-minded, and it fits the film. And in fact, I pick up this song before the film. And I asked my cameraman and the actress, Fei Wong, to listen to this music because I cannot give them a synopsis. I don't have a script. So I just tell them the film should be like this. And that's it.
So you wanted the film to look like California Dreamin' Sounds? Is that?
No, move like.
To move like it.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Because I always ask my cameramans to dance with the camera. So I have to give him some music. Sometimes I give him tango music, like the case in Happy Together. Sometimes I give him California Dreaming. And in Fallen Angels, I just give him Massive Attack.
What were jukeboxes like? What kind of records did they have from different countries?
Bob Dylan, I think, Neil Young, and of course, Bruce Springsteen's, and some Canton pop and Japanese pop. Well, in fact, Hong Kong is like a big cocktail party, you know. You have everything there, and it's fun.
Now, what about movies? I think you were clearly influenced by art films as well as Westerns and action films and dramas and so on. Was it easy to find a variety of films playing growing up in Hong Kong?
Well, I just enjoyed the experience of watching movies because when we moved to Hong Kong, I was only 5 and my father was working in a nightclub. So he normally worked at night and sleep at the daytime. And we don't have any relatives and we cannot speak the local language, which is Cantonese. And my mother is a big fan of movies, so she brings me to cinemas, I think, almost every day after school. And in Hong Kong, you can easily access to Hollywood film, local film, European cinemas, and Japanese film. So to me, just it is something very exciting because I'm just students after school. We just walk into the cinemas with our lunchbox, and I really enjoy the experience. And I don't care, is it a Hollywood film or is it a Japanese film?
So you probably didn't understand what they were saying. You did understand?
Yes. Of course, they're not so difficult because they're spectacular. You know, all those westerns and sometimes the samurai film and some ghost stories. And I think it is kind of an adventure for a kid.
My guest is film director Wong Kar-wai. His new film, Happy Together, played the New York Film Festival last week. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Hong Kong-based film director Wong Kar-wai. His films include Chungking Express and Happy Together. Your family left China when you were five.
Yeah.
In 1963 to move to Hong Kong. My understanding is that you had an older brother and sister who were left behind in Shanghai. Why couldn't they come with you?
Well, because it's by the regulation of the government, I think, you can only take one kid at one time. And my father, because he just settled in Hong Kong, so he thought it's better for me to come with my mother first, because since I'm the youngest, and later on he can ask my mother back to Shanghai and bring the other two. But so happened, it's right before Cultural Revolutions. And when I got to Hong Kong and my mother trying to go back to Shanghai, it's too late already.
So who brought up your older brother and sister?
My grandmother.
It must be interesting to see what a different life they've led from the life you led.
Yes, yes, it is quite... It is quite different because my mother has a very big family in Shanghai, which we have like more than 30 cousins, and we live together. So my childhood before five is very, full of kids and very joyful. And my life in Hong Kong is just me and my mother. And my sister and brothers, they still live with the big family.
And so much of your childhood, it sounds like, was spent in movie theaters. And I would imagine your older brother and sister who grew up in Shanghai didn't get to see these movies, and they probably have experienced so little of what you've experienced in terms of music and movies.
And they spend a lot of time in reading novels. And they read the French, like 18th century novels from Balzac or some Russian novels. And we just write letters to each other. And because I want to catch up with them, so I began to read these big books when I was only like 12 or 13.
So that's interesting. What you shared was, French fiction.
Yes.
That's what you had in common. That's kind of nice. I mean, that you could find something like that.
Yeah.
To share.
Because I'm still feel very close to them, because we are very close when we are very young.
Have they seen any of your movies?
Yes.
In China?
In China, yes. My third film, Ashes of Time, was released in China. And there's some bootleg copy of video of Chungking Express and Fallen Angels in China, too. So they can see the film.
Did they like them?
Well, I'm not sure they like them anyway, but they're very happy to see my film, and they're very proud of it.
I'm wondering if John Woo's success in America, he, for our listeners who don't know his work, he most recently did Face Off, and he too grew up in Hong Kong. I'm wondering if his success in Hollywood is giving you any ideas about coming here.
No, I think I cannot make films like John Woo, so I think his success is
irrelevant.
To me, it is something, I must say, I'm very happy for John, but it's different stories.
Tell me what you mean when you say you can't make films like that. What, how do you see your films as comparing to his?
To me, I think John's film is always very clear. Everything, the narrations, the characters, and everything is very standard. And I think it is very suitable for him to work in Hollywood, and he liked to work in Hollywood, and I think we should be very happy for him.
See, you think that your films are more... What's the word I'm looking for?
Anyway, John works with the script, and I work without the script.
Right.
<difference.
laughs> Well, that's hard to do in Hollywood, isn't it, to work
without
a script?
Yeah, right, I think so.
Before we go, I have to ask you about pineapples.
Yeah.
And for listeners...
It's natural.
For listeners who've seen Chungking Express, there's a scene where a lovesick cop whose girlfriend left him a month ago decides to eat 30 cans of pineapple. She left him 30 days ago. And the day that he's eating this is May 1st. So he's eating 30 cans of pineapple that expire on the day that he's eating them. Would you explain how you got the idea for this? His ex-girlfriend loved pineapples, by the way. So would you explain how you came up with this?
Actually, I like fruits a lot, but I hate pineapple. So I think, well, what is the biggest punishment for a man, for a man like this is to have him eating 30 cans of pineapple. And I actually asked the actor Kinoshiro Takeshi to eat some, you know. And he hates pineapples now.
He hates them now?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I really like pineapple, but as I watched the scene and the actor keeps eating more and
you
more
like
of it.
You like pineapple?
Yes, I like pineapple. You got a problem with that? Pineapples are very good. In moderation.
In a can?
No, fresh. Not
okay.
In a can. The thought
with cream or without cream?
Definitely without cream.
Okay.
But as the scene went on, I mean, it does become a little sickening. And of course, the character does eventually get sick. But how many pineapples did you how many cans of pineapples did you force this poor actor to eat?
I think more than 20.
Did you really?
Yes, but I think it's good because it's a canned pineapple that is so small. It is a small can. If I ask him to eat a fresh pineapple, I think like 20 fresh pineapple, it is too much. God bless you. Don't eat too much pineapple when you have problems, okay?
The movie Chungking Express is available on video. Wong Kar-wai's new movie, Happy Together, is now playing in New York and will open in other cities later this month. He hopes to shoot his next film, Beijing Summer, in Hong Kong and Beijing. He's been waiting 6 months for a permit to shoot in China. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new thriller, Rough Justice. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. The women lawyers who star in Lisa Scottolini's thrillers must pit themselves against hostile judges, murderous clients, and the daily dilemma of what to wear in the courtroom. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of Scottolini's new novel, Rough Justice.
John Grisham has spawned so many imitators, they could pack the Supreme Court 10 times over. But among this crowd of lawyer-writer half-breeds, Lisa Scottolini stands out because of the tightness of her plots and the gender of her attorney heroes. They're almost always women. Her latest novel, Rough Justice, is a giddy thriller. But to enjoy it, you have to suspend your disbelief about the one crucial event that sets the plot in motion. When Rough Justice opens, attorney Marta Richter is having a jailhouse chat with her client, Elliot Steer, a multimillionaire Philadelphia developer who shot a homeless man dead, allegedly in self-defense. Marta has mesmerized the courtroom on Steer's behalf, and the jury has just retired for the evening to deliberate the case. Everyone expects a not guilty verdict to be handed down within 24 hours. Then Marta hopes she and Steer can act on their mutual sexual attraction. Sparks flew every time their knees bumped under the defense table. Steer, however, squelches Marta's erotic fantasies when he abruptly confesses to her that he killed the homeless man in cold blood. "You're a murderer," she gasps. "No, I'm a problem solver," Steer retorts, explaining how, thanks to him, the city has one less piece of human flotsam to salvage. Steer then cockily reminds Marta that they've been speaking under the protection of attorney-client privilege. If she repeats their grisly conversation, she'll be disbarred. Now, what would you expect Marta to do when Steer launches into his homicidal boasting? Does she clap her hands to her ears and loudly begin reciting the 6-figure sum she's receiving for defending him? Or does she resolve to find incriminating evidence against him in the few hours she has left before the jury clears him? Well, if it's conceivable that Marv Albert is not going to write a book about his recent troubles, I guess it's also conceivable that a lawyer could place the abstract concept of justice above her own reputation and retainer. So go ahead, believe. Because if this far-fetched premise causes you to abandon Rough Justice, you'll miss out on a very clever thriller. Not since Ben Franklin launched his kite has Philadelphia been the scene of such electrifying suspense. In her 4 earlier books, Scottolini established a good track record for creating gutsy attorney heroines. Here, she presents a veritable chorus line of lady lawyers, sporting personality problems and nerves of steel. Some young associates in an all-female law firm help Marta gather evidence against Steer, even as Philadelphia is being buried by what delirious weather people are calling the blizzard of the century. As all these lawyers stumble around the snowbound city chasing after clues, they're being hunted, in turn, by Steer's sadistic henchmen. It seems Steer has regretted his earlier boasting to Marta and has decided that the only good lawyer is a dead one. The ticking clock and the thickly falling snow ratchet up the tension here to deliciously excruciating levels. Through the device of the blizzard, Scottolini imbues Philadelphia and environs with the eerie attributes of a Gothic castle, where ghouls wait beyond every turn. There's even a frenetic race out to Steer's Victorian mansion on the Jersey shore, where snow, salt water, and blood mingle on the icy beach. For a bunch of paper pushers, these female attorneys sure can move, scaling snow piles, dodging bullets, and fighting off psychopaths with aplomb. They need to maintain that aerobic level till the very last frantic pages of this novel, when Steer's fate will be determined by the lawyer with the fleetest feet. If they keep up this pace, Scottolini's heroines will be giving Grisham's ambulance chasers a real run for their money.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Rough Justice by Lisa Scottolini. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Monique Nazareth. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. Katie Balser is our intern. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.